Welcome to 5-Minute Journal Club. I'm medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. Today, meeting with Dr. Seth Wander from the Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston to review several recent papers on oral SERDs, selective estrogen receptor degraders, with one agent, elacestrant, approved and moving forward quickly. To begin, we talk about a paper describing the rationale for one of the most interesting ongoing trials in medical oncology, the Phase 3 SERENA-6 first-line trial in ER-positive, HER2-negative metastatic breast cancer, in which patients are treated with palbociclib and anastrozole, but patients will be monitored both for clinical progression, but also whether or not ESR1 mutations develop, in which case there will be a randomization to either continue anastrozole or switch even in the patient with only tumor biomarker positive disease. To begin, Dr. Wander reviewed some of the superb graphics in this paper looking at the mechanism of action of endocrine therapy of breast cancer. So let's talk a little bit about SERDs in the first-line metastatic setting, and we know there are a bunch of trials looking at that, including one looking at another SERD, camizestrant. Can you talk a little bit using camizestrant as an example of how these agents work and what's going to be looked at in these first-line trials?
What you're seeing here in this diagram is you have the estrogen receptor, which are these two tubes, and you have the estrogen ligand, which is the green circle, and then you have the drug, the oral SERD, which is the kind of red hexagon there. Now, if the green circle, the estrogen, binds the receptor, it goes down into the nucleus and it promotes gene transcription. If the drug binds the receptor, it serves two purposes. First, it promotes degradation, right? Like SERDs, like all SERDs do, selective estrogen receptor degraders, it promotes degradation of the receptor. Second, if the receptor gets into the nucleus and binds to the DNA, it blocks transcription. So it's an ER antagonist if it's on the DNA in the nucleus. It's also a degrader if it's in the cytoplasm and it can target the receptor for disposal. So on the top left here, we're looking at the wild type scenario. So there's no drug involved here, okay? You have wild type estrogen receptor in the blue box, and then you have the ESR1 mutant estrogen receptor in the red sort of pinkish box. Now the wild type receptor, you need the ligand. You have to have estrogen coming into the cell. It has to bind the receptor. That gets down into the nucleus and promotes gene transcription. If you have the ESR1 mutation in the ligand binding domain that we just looked at on that diagram a few minutes ago, you don't need the ligand. The protein is turned on whether or not estrogen is present. On the bottom, we're seeing what happens when you add the next generation oral SERD, and this is similar to the diagram we saw before. Here, camizestrant binds in the cytoplasm to both the wild type normal and mutant receptors and targets them both for degradation. It doesn't matter. It doesn't have to be the ESR1 mutant. If that receptor gets into the nucleus and it has the camizestrant bound, it stops the transcription of the gene. So it's an antagonist. It blocks the activity of the ER. Again, it doesn't matter whether they're wild type or they're mutant. So what they're showing here is that the camizestrant's beneficial regardless of the ESR1, and it serves two purposes. It serves to degrade the receptor, and it serves to block the activity if it gets past the degradation into the nucleus and binds the DNA. So usually I tell patients and other clinicians that the frequency of ESR1 alteration at baseline, very rare, you know, less than 5%. As you start to get through various lines of therapy, it might get up to 20%, 30%, even up to 50%, probably in the third plus line set after multiple lines of endocrine-based treatment. Here's the SERENA-6 study, which is a really interesting and progressive study. You have 3,000 patients, hormone receptor positive advanced disease. They had at least 6 months on first line aromatase inhibitor plus CDK4/6 inhibitor, letrozole or anastrozole plus palbo or abema. They had to have good performance status, no prior fulvestrant or prior SERD. What they do is they test for ESR1 every couple of cycles, every 2 to 3 cycles. And if a patient has ESR1 that pops up and they do not have radiographic or clinical progression, then they come into this study and they are randomized just with the genetic ESR1 rising to either stay on their current regimen, AI plus CDK, or switch to camizestrin and continue the CDK. So this is a really forward-looking study that, if it's positive, has the potential not only to change the way we think about breast cancer, but in my opinion, could really change the way we think about solid tumor clinical trial design across the board if you have an acquired targetable alteration. The logic here is that in identifying that alteration early, subclonal, before clinical progression, and attacking it with a newer, better drug will pay clinical dividends later on in terms of time to progression, overall survival, hopefully quality of life, time to chemotherapy, et cetera. So several clinical trials underway looking at next generation oral SERDs for hormone receptor positive metastatic breast cancer. Serena 6, in my opinion, really pivotal, potentially provocative, field-changing study outside of breast cancer if it's positive.
Let's talk about this study looking at the patient-reported outcomes in patients in the EMERALD study. The other factor they reported on that was really interesting was the impact of elacestrant based on how long they were actually on a CDK4/6 inhibitor, where the patients who were on CDK for 6 months or less did not do anywhere near as well as the patients who were on for, 12 months or more. Getting back to the outcome data, what were your thoughts?
There was no difference between the EMERALD group and the elacestrant group and the standard of care, either in physical functioning, role functioning, quality of life. Here's the data from the EQ5D5L. And again, no difference in terms of the elacestrant versus the standard of care for different dimensions, including mobility, self-care, activities, usual activities. And here was the data from the PRO CTCAE. For the most part, there was no difference across the two populations. With the exception of nausea and vomiting, there seemed to be a little bit of a signal as patients got up to cycle 5, cycle 6, that the degree of nausea and vomiting was a little bit worse with the standard of care as compared to elacestrant.
So one question kind of came into my mind as I was listening to you talk about the patient-reported outcomes. Is that, a lot of times the focus, as it seemed to be here, was on toxicity from the treatment. But the other factor is symptoms from the tumor. So my question is, in general, when you look at people in this general situation who are getting oral SERDs, not just elacestrant, what fraction of them generally are symptomatic? I think a lot of them would be if you include fatigue from tumor, if you include bone pain. And then what fraction do you think actually have improvement in tumor-related symptomatology from SERDs?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. Thanks, Neil. It's also a bit of a moving target because looking at the EMERALD data, we've begun to kind of train ourselves as clinicians to choose a specific population of patients to get these next generation oral antiestrogens. So for example, we tend to choose these patients not only, of course, who are ESR1 mutant, but who have demonstrated perhaps more indolent disease course and more sensitivity on prior antiestrogen and CDK inhibitor. A lot of these patients might have bone-only disease. They may have been on their prior regimen for 2, 3, 4 years. So I think in general, symptom burden here might be a little bit less than what we would experience with visceral disease or more aggressive metastatic disease. I can say anecdotally in my own practice, these patients tend to do pretty well, but you're absolutely right. These patients have 1, 2, or more prior lines of therapy. They may have other symptoms outside of the drug, including fatigue or bone pain. We're working with our colleagues on the palliative care team all the time to try to address those not only drug-related but tumor-related quality of life. And I think those patients who remain endocrine sensitive, who have demonstrated that the tumor is still really ER-dependent, they can gain benefit in terms of their symptom and quality of life from elacestrant or other strategies that we're going to talk about.
Yeah, it was just like we were just doing a program on small cell, and it's very different thinking about a patient who's symptomatic in the hospital with small cell getting patient-reported outcome compared to a patient who probably is going to get picked up on progression maybe before they even get symptomatic by imaging or some other modality.
So 100%, and we're lucky in that sense in breast cancer that many of our patients are doing really well outside of the hospital. Their symptoms are under good control with oral agents without needing aggressive cytotoxic chemo, for the most part.
The last paper for this issue of 5-Minute Journal Club relates to a topic not discussed very often in medical oncology, the use of endocrine therapy in patients with HER2-positive disease. specifically a paper of imlunestrant combined with HER2-targeted therapy.
As might be expected, we have lots of experience now with all of these drugs, including the imlunestrant, tends to be very well tolerated, mostly low-grade expected toxicities. And then here are the waterfall plots, and you can see, as might be expected with the triplet, we have kind of more and deeper responses in terms of stability, and then some patients getting a partial response. We think that this triplet combination has promising preclinical, you know, clinical activity, preliminary evidence of that, and that this may be a meaningful addition, these oral SERDs like imlunestrant, to the combinations for patients with HER2-positive, ER-positive advanced breast cancer.
Could I just follow this up by asking, in general, how you think about endocrine therapy in patients with HER2-positive disease in terms of clinical management outside a clinical trial?
Yeah, this is a really important question, and it's an area where we need more larger prospective clinical trials, particularly as we have these newer hormonal and targeted agents. I typically don't deploy the currently available CDK4/6 inhibitors either in the early stage or in the metastatic setting for HER2-positive disease. It's not that I don't believe that there's relevant biology there and that there might be a role. I just don't think we have the evidence yet. We need more and larger studies like this, looking at toxicity, looking at outcomes. For patients that are truly ER positive, HER2 positive, we try to integrate the anti-estrogen therapy really when the patient's off chemotherapy and we have them kind of on a maintenance regimen. And we're thinking about sort of optimizing the duration of treatment as well as their quality of life. And again, it'll depend a little bit on what did they get in the early stage, you know, adjuvant setting. What have they gotten so far in the metastatic setting? Do we think we have disease control and we're kind of off of chemotherapy and on maintenance treatment? And we'll cycle through some of the available, you know, traditional anti-estrogen agents that won't add much toxicity to the maintenance HER2-directed therapy.